You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
And we're back. Welcome to Columbia Calling 2019. We're here in Bogota, Colombia. The first episode of this new year. Yes, there's been a little bit of a break in the last couple of months. Of course it has, because, you know, we've been on holiday. But this is episode 256, and we're back, you know, with this year with a fervor. We want to keep on going in the strong vein of form that we've been going on since last year. And it's a great pleasure of mine to announce that from next week, episode 257, we'll be partnering with Columbia Report. So the largest English news website in Colombia, great for updates about news in this situation that is Colombia. So Adrian Alselma, the editor and director of Columbia Reports, will be providing us with a weekly news update at the beginning of each show. So just letting you know that's going to be taking place. And so you'll hear, well, a crazy Dutch accent at the beginning of the show each week. Anon. And this week, episode 256, I'm talking to Michael Evans, who's the director and senior analyst of the Columbia Project. That's the National Security Archive up there in Washington, D.C. He's an expert on all things Columbia, author of the Chiquita Papers. Those of you out there who know about Columbia will know what that's about. And of course, very interested and very up to speed on what's going on with the Truth Commission, or what's not going on with the Truth Commission in Colombia. So, Michael, thank you so much for being on Columbia Calling.
Thanks for having me on, Richard. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
No, it's fascinating to have you on the line. It's fascinating to be chatting away. Can you tell us a little bit about this Truth Commission? I know that in 2017, President Santos inaugurated it, but what really is going on now under the new President Duque?
Yeah, I mean, you know, really, it was just inaugurated a month ago formally. They've been up, you know, working for, you know, 6 months at least, I think, prior to that, trying to get things started. And with President Duque, you know, there's been a certain amount of uncertainty. Obviously, he's taking a slightly different approach to the transitional justice process. I think, you know, most of us have seen how that's affected the special jurisdiction for peace and sort of the idea of having maybe a special tribunal just for ex-members of the military with slightly different terms. You know, with the Truth Commission, it's maybe a little bit less controversial than the special jurisdiction for peace. Of course, it's an extra legal body, which isn't going to, you know, actually prosecute anyone. But the truth is always controversial. And that's really sort of the main thing for them, is trying to get at, you know, what is the truth? Try to put together a more complete version of the truth, you know, seen from the many different perspectives that you've got in Colombia. And obviously, you know, there's a lot of things that are key to that, you know, getting the testimonies of participants, of victims, obviously is one of the most important things. But in addition to that, documentation, you know, contemporaneous documentation is extremely important. People write things down. People in Colombia, members of the military, members of all the various armed actors keep track of things. And of course, from my perspective, something that's very important is the view of the United States. That's something we specialize in, is sort of uncovering these secret archives of the United States. And for a truth commission like the one in Colombia, or like essentially every truth commission that has been formed around the world in the last 30 years, it's important to sort of gain that perspective, you know, of the United States, because it's been very difficult for many of these commissions, and it's no less difficult in Colombia, to access the archives that they need in their own countries. There's always some controversy about truth commissions and about what they might find. And in Colombia, it's complicated by the fact that, you know, there hasn't been a change of regime. There hasn't been a military dictatorship, you know, that kind of becomes discredited, you know, during the peace process or anything. So you're talking about there's a lot of continuity in Colombia. And to some extent, because of that, I think some reluctance to really dig into some of the history that might expose some of the corrupt actors or some of the human rights violations that that are committed by state agents. And of course, it's not just state agents, it's about trying to cover, you know, come to a complete picture of sort of all of these various violations from all the sides of the conflict. So the perspective of the United States can be really important if you don't think you're going to have access to everything that you need there in Colombia. And of course, the United States has been a key actor, you know, from really before the Cold War, but especially during the Cold War. And then, you know, Colombia is in this sort of unique position where as the Cold War wound down, Colombia was one of the countries where you really saw some of the kind of Cold War U.S. security problems as they became, to, you know, came to be redefined after the Cold War, you know, really kind of on steroids, you know, the narcotics trafficking, Pablo Escobar, the cartels. These were the, sort of the obvious next things for the United States to get its, you know, hands involved in around the world and in Latin America. So there was this sort of very fluid, I guess, transition from Cold War security problems to post-Cold War security problems in Colombia, which meant that, you know, there was a real continuity in the involvement of the United States in Colombia. So that all that documentation, you know, from the 50s, 60s, you know, 70s during the Cold War, and then into the 90s and beyond with some of these post-Cold War problems. And of course, the FARC itself is a remnant of the Cold War in many ways. So you've got a lot of this documentation in the United States, the State Department, the CIA, military intelligence, all of them trying to discover and learn different things about the conflict and keep track of what's going on, so that they can make, you know, better informed decisions. And now that represents a really tremendous resource for a truth commission, or indeed for the special jurisdiction, which will be prosecuting people for war crimes in Colombia. That's contemporaneous documentation, and it's not necessarily the 100% truth, but it is represents a very valuable perspective from some of these, you know, U.S. diplomats and intelligence agencies, law enforcement agencies like the Drug Enforcement Administration. All of that documentation can be extremely useful and has been for truth commissions around the world.
This is absolutely fascinating. And just, I mean, at your desk at the moment, are you sifting through documentation that will have an effect on the Colombian Truth Commission? Obviously, you probably can't tell me yet because you're working on stuff, but is there documentation there at the moment that is going to reveal, I don't know, major truths here in Colombia?
Well, I'd like to think so. I think that for one thing, we're doing a number of things, you know, to sort of help the Truth Commission, which is kind of a serving as, you know, their work and their responsibilities over the next 3 years is something that we're using as sort of a guide post for what we're going to work on for the next 3 years. And obviously their mandate is pretty broad. They're looking at, you know, the sort of trying to understand the origins of the conflict, the kind of development of the policies of the various armed actors, and a lot of these big picture issues and you know, phenomena that you're not necessarily going to see spelled out so much by the Special Jurisdiction for Peace. They're going to be trying people for specific crimes and getting very focused on certain violations, where the Truth Commission has a much kind of broader mandate in order to try to understand the big picture. And so when you get into things like what are the responsibilities of multinational corporations, or you think about support for paramilitarism in Colombia, or for the insurgents, you're talking about a phenomenon that was in some ways very widespread. In certain parts of the country, there was an incredible amount of support for the paramilitaries. So how do you understand that phenomenon without necessarily, you know, bringing this specific person for justice for forming a paramilitary front? How do you understand that phenomenon where, you know, ranchers in Antioquia were, you know, for the large part, supportive of the paramilitaries, narco traffickers and their role in the conflict? I think it's important to understand these broad sweeps, and we can really help with that because throughout the 1990s and beyond, especially, there was a lot of effort in the United States. And, you know, some say it would be sort of self-serving, but I think that when you really dig into it, you start to understand that there is a real concerted effort, you know, in the United States, among diplomats, intelligence agencies, to understand the picture. You know, I'm talking about before policy decisions are made, to, you know, understand what are we dealing with? You know, who is the FARC? What are their various fronts? What does this front do? You know, well, this front is involved in collecting money from so-and-so. This front is more of a military front. And it's the same thing with the Colombian Army itself. What did the 5th Brigade do? What did the 17th Brigade, what were their responsibilities? What was the nature of their ties to paramilitaries? Who were the generals and colonels in the military who had the strongest ties to the paramilitaries? How do you even understand that phenomenon? Was that a centralized policy? Was that something that just sort of naturally happened among, you know, commanders in particular regions? You know, these are the kinds of things that an observer of the conflict, also a participant, obviously, but an observer of the conflict like the United States can, I think, have a really valuable perspective. You know, and you have to understand also, of course, that during the Cold War, I think, as we all know, the United States spent a lot of money and put a lot of resources into developing its intelligence capabilities. And after a certain point, particularly, you know, from the beginning of the 1990s and beyond, intelligence, U.S. intelligence support to Colombia, U.S. intelligence observation of Colombia of all kinds, from the very technical satellite imagery, eavesdropping, sophisticated eavesdropping techniques, to the most basic, you know, human intelligence, things picked up by our military attachés at cocktail parties, these kinds of things. All of that gets reported back. And that's, you know, streams and streams of raw intelligence that can be extremely useful, I think, when you are talking about trying to understand the conflict. And from a unique and sort of privileged perspective that the United States had. I hope I'm answering your question. I sort of forgot even what the original one was.
No, but I mean, it's like you're privy to so much information there, the information that we possibly don't have and probably don't have here in Colombia, aside from personal testimonies. I have it on good sources, and I can't name the person, but who has been, he's been reviewing, he's a Colombian, been reviewing various documents from different military bases. So he's working for the military, but he's a sociologist. And he says the destruction of the documentation that has gone on in the last few years, I guess since about 2015, has been systemic. I mean, just absolutely rife. You know, so they're trying to hide, obviously, crimes from the past.
Yeah, I mean, these reports are very concerning, obviously. I've heard many of these reports, too. And it's all that, again, is not unusual when there it's, you know, it's been known for a long time that a truth commission was coming, that there would be some sort of war crimes tribunal. So, you know, in a way, it's very predictable. It would have been better if there had been more leadership early on to sort of try to make sure that these files got protected. I think, you know, to some extent that was done, but I don't think nearly enough of it happened. And yeah, so you have reports like this. I mean, you know, of course, by finding of the Constitutional Court, the special jurisdiction, the Truth Commission, the special unit to search for the disappeared, they're supposed to have access to all of the files they need to do their work. There's a question in my mind, and maybe there's an answer to it, of, you know, who actually finds, you know, what's needed and what's not needed. And I think that, you know, the other problem is that with, we're talking about state entities, the commission, the special jurisdiction. These are creatures of the state. Although I think, you know, with a lot of independence, I believe they're trying impartial work and act independently. However, they can't go to court to try to get the files they need. Essentially, there's a negotiation process. And I think, you know, negotiating for access to military records in Colombia is always going to be fraught with difficulties. We saw earlier this year, I mean, the result of one negotiation with them was that certain kinds of intelligence files were declared off limits. Now, who's to say that those were not essential to them completing their mission? So I think there's all kinds of problems like that. You know, we're talking about some of the most sensitive records that they were concerned about sharing were, you know, biographical profiles of intelligence commanders in the military and those sorts of things. And that's, you know, that's a specific area where we can help. You know, we have a lot of very specific information about some of these guys. You look at people like General Ivan Ramirez, some of these people who were very closely associated with, you know, top level command of military intelligence, who are known to have had strong ties to the paramilitaries, who were known to have ties to criminal organizations and narco-trafficking. Now, this kind of stuff is only going to come out if you have access to the most sensitive files. And you go back to, there's this document I used to work on. We have a Guatemala project, and we had a project specifically to help the Truth Commission process in Guatemala in the late 1990s. I was a sort of a lower level person on that project. But, you know, if you remember back then, there was the same problem, anticipating a Truth Commission coming. It was very clear that there was destruction, not just of documents happening and documentary evidence, but also physical evidence. Pits that were used to hold and presumably torture detainees were being filled in and covered up. So there's all kinds of ways these kinds of things can happen. You know, bodies being dug up and moved or destroyed. There's many ways in which that happens. And it's in the future, you know, as you look toward, you know, maybe a pre-peace process, a transitional justice process happening in other countries, I hope some of these problems can be fixed, you know, where the first steps will be, you know, ensuring that sites are protected, that records can be recovered, so that you're not, you know, in the middle of the process years later discovering that, you know, things have been removed. And I think another part of this, you know, it's not just about government records, although I'm quite sure that there's probably been some attempt to conceal some of that. You know, paramilitary records, obviously, you know, these were sophisticated organizations, and they're insurgents as well. Sophisticated organizations with business operations, streams of income. Obviously, some of that they have. Some of that has been turned over. Some of that has been found on laptops here and there. Obviously, there's some of that. But you're always going to be having, you know, you're going to be seeing a partial picture of the archival record, you know, very small percentage of what exists. So, you know, we're going to try to, you know, hear from our perspective, sort through what we have. And we have, you know, thousands and thousands of records, you know, probably hundreds of thousands of pages, and try to find out, you know, figure out, organize it in a way that will be informative and helpful. One of the things we've done is with the Truth Commission, we shared a database, you know, essentially of all of the records that we have on Colombia. You know, it's something you can search through and people can, you know, you can search for a specific word, but it's also a little bit overwhelming. You know, you might search for, some particular term and you might turn up hundreds of records, and they're written in English, of course, because we're talking about U.S. records. So, you know, for a person who doesn't speak English all that fluently, it's really helpful if we can create sort of packages, smaller packages of documentation with some analysis, you know, where we've applied some of our expertise to the situation and say, okay, well, here are 20 documents or 50 documents on this particular case. Say, for instance, the 1997 massacre at Mapiripan, or the false positives scandal. So you can sort of focus in on what some of those priorities are. So that's one of the things we've been trying to do with the Truth Commission, is to understand you know, to the extent possible, you know, what are their priorities? Where will they focus? Are they going to, you know, highlight a certain region as a case study or emblematic human rights violations? Obviously, there are far too many violations in Colombia to cover them all. So you have to pick maybe the most egregious ones or the most symbolic or emblematic ones. So for us, it helps in touch, you know, on a very professional level as a source, one of their sources, as, you know, to see what we can bring to bear, you know, to inform the discussions and the research that they're doing. You know, I like to stress, you know, I don't think that the United States has all the answers to these questions. And obviously the most important archives are those that are in Colombia. So another really important thing is to understand where these gaps are, you know, in Colombia. Obviously they have access to a lot of records from the Fiscalía. They have, you know, expedientes, you know, case files. These sorts of things, I think, are one area where they are getting good access. So, you know, where can we help? And of course, what is most sort of robustly reflected in U.S. files? And that depends a lot on what U.S. priorities have been. So, you know, this is sort of where we sit.
Fantastic and so very interesting, and you really clearly are the person to talk to. So on message, listen, we're going to take a short break here, but for those of you listening, this is episode 256 of the Columbia Calling podcast. That's the first episode, 2019. We're talking to Michael Evans, director, senior analyst of the Columbia Project for the National Security Archive up there in Washington. We're talking about the Truth Commission and other very, very important topics in Colombia. So we'll be back after this short break and we'll talk further about such fascinating topics with Michael Evans. Thank you for listening. Don't go away. And we're back. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. This is the first episode of 2019, episode 256. And as you know, we are talking to Michael Evans, who is the senior analyst and director of the Colombia Project, the National Security Archive, the man to talk to, really, when it comes down to issues about the Truth Commission and, of course, let's say political violence and U.S. policy in Colombia and how it all affects. Now, Michael, you've been talking at length about the Truth Commission, and what I have clear for my listeners, there are sort of three key points. Obviously, there's many key points, but the three key points is to shed light on the conflict and offer a wide-ranging explanation of its complexity, to promote and contribute to recognition of victims of the conflict and the recognition of a society as a whole that the conflict should be both rejected and never repeated, and finally, to promote coexistence in the affected areas as a guarantee of non-repetition. And of course, so I see this as a national conversation, and there are benefits, of course, you know, the recovered dignity of victims, people become aware of their rights as citizens and the relationship between citizen and state, you know, amongst other things. But I mean, do we really think that this is possible? I mean, the complexity of the conflict here, and well, I want to ask, I mean, you know, when we talk about a truth commission, when does it date back until, and how are we going to find all of that information, and how can we come to terms with, let's say, something that happened in 1964 or prior to that, as opposed to something in 1980 or 1990? And the fear I have is that there's a half-hearted truth commission, that it's really done in a lackadaisical manner, and we turn the page and then nothing happens. And Colombia again says, well, we did it. We're the example for future truth commissions now. And, you know, what's the danger of such an event taking place?
Those are really good questions, Richard. You know, yeah, I mean, the danger is, like you said, you know, that they just sort of go through the motions and turn the page and say that, you know, we've done this. I think that, yeah, those are, and, you know, promoting reconciliation in the territories and that sort of thing is difficult. I mean, but, you know, the first step is, I think, sort of guaranteeing, and you know, it's right, you know, for the, you know, the transitional justice process in Colombia has really put victims at the center of the process. It's been a very, you know, sort of Colombian thing, I think, to talk first of victims, and that's right, I think, you know, to protect their rights. And, you know, those rights include, you know, the right to truth. And when you talk about grave violations of human rights, and that's, you know, one of the key things that the Truth Commission is doing, is to look at the most egregious violations and try to understand them. And that's not just an individual right for the victims of those specific crimes. That's a societal right, because, you know, the Inter-American system, and, you know, it's a fairly well-established principle under international law now that, you know, the right to know, the right to truth, is something that is a right of society and not just of victims. Because, you know, if you really are trying to make sure that there's no repetition of these crimes, people have to understand the nature of them, and that right, the right to truth, and the right to know what happened, is something that, you know, comes up against concerns about. Often concerns about national security, concerns about, you know, law enforcement having, you know, not exposing the techniques that they use to investigate these things, privacy rights of individuals involved in these crimes. And those are real problems, you know, you need to protect some information while revealing the most essential information. And what I think has emerged is this idea that when we're talking about, you know, these massive crimes, you know, dozens of people killed, you know, especially where there's a pattern of this happening again and again, maybe not in the same place around the country, this phenomenon, you know, of political murder, you know, whether it's presumed guerrilla supporters or people who didn't even have any presumed connection to an armed group, like the false positives case. These are egregious crimes. And understanding the nature of them, how they're investigated, and whether there was any justice done is the first step. You know, this is a belief. This is a strongly held belief. But, you know, can we say that this is necessarily going to bring peace to Colombia or any sense of reconciliation? I mean, you can count on a Truth Commission alone to do that, or even a Truth Commission that also is sort of has this sister entity in the special jurisdiction, and of course the unit for the search for the disappeared. I mean, there are cleavages in Colombian society clearly that need to be resolved, and a Truth Commission can do something, but I think it needs to be stressed, and I Father DeRue would probably say this, and pretty much anybody involved in the process, is that they have specific jobs. And number one, the first of which for the Truth Commission is to get at the truth, you know, try to understand it better and understand why the conflict happened. Because if you don't know why the conflict happened, and, you know, admittedly, you know, I've been studying this for years, I don't know that I can give you a straight answer on why it happened. Everybody has a different view. I think even among the truth commissioners, there are probably a diversity of views as to why the conflict happened and why it persisted. But there are certain fundamental truths. And, you know, I'm more, I guess, historian. I don't have a PhD, but I would say I'm more of a historian or a journalist than a political theorist. So I'm not going to sit here and try to tell you, oh, I have this theory about why conflict happens. I don't know. But I can look at individual episodes. You can track the actors, what their motivations are. You can try to understand the dynamics of, say, the U.S. drug war, which is obviously a huge part of this, and try to understand, you know, the widespread nature of, you know, I guess you'd call it corruption in Colombia that has contributed to this. And I think, you know, I don't want to focus on this exclusively, but narco-trafficking has been a huge problem, you know, fueling all of this. And it's very clear how closely tied the illegal drug trade was to sort of the birth of paramilitarism, you know, at least the modern form of paramilitarism in the 1990s. So there's a lot of that. So maybe there's some lessons that policymakers can draw from a Truth Commission report. I think, you know, the most important thing is that, you know, that it has credibility. And to do that, they're going to need to listen to all sides. They're going to need to listen to the military's point of view, the guerrillas' point of view, and hopefully the point of view of international actors and contributors as well. But they need, yeah, I mean, it needs to be seen as credible. You know, I think, for instance, the National Center for Historical Memory, led until recently by the very well-respected Gonzalo Sanchez, they did a really terrific job, I think, in establishing their credibility, seeming, you know, nonpartisan, and really writing these fantastic reports, many of them. And, of course, reports that are going to be sort of absorbed and considered by the Truth Commission as a kind of a, you know, almost an extension of the same work that the center was doing. So, you know, there is this culture, I think, in Colombia that's grown up around, you know, looking for the truth and hopefully, you know, cutting through some of the more conspiratorial things and trying to just understand what's documented and what's not. And I'll, you know, just to go back to sort of our role, I think there's a way that the U.S. documentation can really help. And one of the things that I'm finding more and more, I mean, it's obvious, but, you know, as I study the records and as I go through the documentation, the one of the things that I really discover is that, and you know, I think this is a weakness of early on in the process, I tended to not ignore, but I wanted to, in some ways, downplay the role of drug trafficking and the importance of it to try to understand the conflict, you know, as a Cold War conflict between, you know, guerrilla insurgents, the state, and sort of this left-right Cold War phenomenon. And it is that. But it's increasingly clear to me how important the drug trade was, the drug war, if we can call it that, has been in Colombia. And to really, and given that, to learn that some of the most files I think that exist, at least from a U.S. standpoint, are those of the Drug Enforcement Administration and the country office in Colombia. Because, you know, you're talking about a group that had pretty tight relations with law enforcement in Colombia, you know, to the extent where there was a lot of technical assistance, a lot of involvement in surveillance operations. And the narco trade touched everything, you know, common crime, normal, you know, criminal behavior, the insurgents were involved, the paramilitaries are involved, politicians, members of the military. That really touches, you know, all of Colombian society in, you know, one form or another. So, you know, to go back to the question, I mean, I don't know how you can count on the Truth Commission to do all this itself. I think it's, you know, they lay out this ambitious framework, you know, get at the truth and then disseminate the truth and then promote reconciliation. And they're going to try to do all of that. And I think that Father DeRue is a wonderful choice to be the president of the commission and somebody who, if anybody, can try to promote that, you know, and do the best possible job. But it's incumbent upon society. You know, you can't just rely on the staff at the Truth Commission to make this work. There needs to be a commitment. And, you know, hopefully you see, as time goes on, maybe a bit more commitment to this process from the current government. It would be nice to see them, you know, just giving a little bit more support. The relationship to me, you know, from reading the press, which is, you know, way most people get this information, it seems contentious. It seems like there's been a lot of conflict over how the process should play out, attempts to change it, alter it, weaken it, change things. And, you know, I don't think that's the right approach. I think that it's extremely important that the Truth Commission has the support of the state, of the military, and that they buy into the process. And, you know, I think that's where you're going to run into problems, is when you have prominent people, prominent members of society who are raising questions, who are trying to sort of take it down a peg. And, you know, that happens all the time. I mean, you know, Guatemala, I think their Truth Commission actually was pretty fabulous. There was the UN-sponsored one. There was the one sponsored by the Catholic Church, and their reports were really, really informative, and I think remain, in many ways, like the defining history of that conflict. And yet, you know, where is Guatemala today? I mean, there have been some necessary steps taken. There has been prosecutions. There have been attempts, you know, at sort of finding historical justice there. But you know, it's much bigger than these three entities. And I think that there's going to need to be a change, you know, at societal level. And I don't know how to bring that about.
If Francisco de Rua is permitted to do his job and his team, then it will be an excellent document. But you think about the framework and the time that they're being given to do this. But I feel I should come back to what you were saying. It's like you wanted to separate the narco trafficking from the conflict. And I think you're right. And forgive me if I'm overstepping my knowledge here, but I think the beginning, of course, and up to a certain period, even into the 70s, when it was the Cold War, and then the evolution of the narco money coming into it, and we have to recognize that it touches every single level of society, as you say. But what I as we sort of start winding down this, and it's just too much to talk about, is I want to bring it into the current. The current climate and the current day. There's a BBC report out, or just, you know, an article out recently, just saying, you know, mentioning the 85 members of the FARC having been killed. And of course, we know about everybody knows about this absolute, I don't like to use the word genocidal, but this assassination of community and social leaders across the country. I don't even want to hazard a guess at how many they are now. We need to move forward, and we need to have truth, but at the same time, these issues are still taking place. This is systematic killing. And I don't know if you have the answers to this, or things have been revealed in former documents that maybe you've seen. So we know who pulls the trigger. We know who the assassins are. We know who the sicarios are. But who's giving the order for this stuff? That's really what I think that ties into my final sort of comments, really. I mean, you know the Chiquita papers, back to front and everything. These documents naming the company executives who authorized these payments for paramilitaries. There's a bigger problem here, isn't there, behind what we see in the news. And I sometimes fear that it's not being reported, it's not being told. We had, I would say, elements of it at the end of 2018 and the outrage against Angulo Sarmiento and stuff like that. But, I mean, I know it's a huge and loaded question, and I don't know if you've got anything you'd like to add to that.
Oh, well, I mean, you know, about Chiquita, you know, I think it's a fascinating case study. And, you know, one of the best documented, maybe the best documented, at least for now, case of a multinational's kind of involvement in the conflict. Although, you know, as the Odebrecht scandal kind of opens up, and as we start to see more documentation from that, hopefully, perhaps that will surpass it. But, you know, with Chiquita, it's a fascinating thing, because on the one hand, it's not as simple, I don't think, as to say, oh, well, Chiquita set up paramilitaries and they went out to kill people. But it's also not simply a case of, well, Chiquita had no choice and what could they do? It's a complicated system at work here. Chiquita made a decision to sort of reinvigorate its holdings and its production of fruit and shipping of fruit from Colombia in the late 1980s. And that was the decision they made, fully knowing how violent that region was and how difficult it would be to work there. And it should have been easy to anticipate that there would be, you know, relationships they would have to establish with insurgents at first. And then, you know, later it became increasingly clear that the relationships, needed to be, they needed to sort of foster relationships with the paramilitaries. But what I think is indicative of is you know, in Colombia, you know, Chiquita walked into to a situation where there was a lot of conflict, and there was this system on the ground that involved the insurgents, the paramilitaries, the military itself, the DOS. You know, if you look through their records, it's not just about payments they made to the paramilitaries. That's what we all hear about. Okay, they made these payments to the paramilitaries. That's what got them in trouble in the United States, because the AUC, after a certain point, was a foreign terrorist organization in capital letters, you know. So that raised certain legal issues in the United States. But, you know, before that, years and years of payments to the FARC, the ELN, the EPL, other insurgent groups. You know, before that, the Comandos Populares, which was like the armed wing of the Esperanza political movement, which then the Comandos went on to become, you know, part of the ACCU. And payments all along to members of the military, people who were facilitating the transactions, payments to the Convivir, which of course were, you know, supposedly, you know, overseen by the military and were, you know, creatures of the state. All of that, you know, it was a situation where I think they were to do business in Colombia. It was assumed that you were going to kind of buy into this system. So it's not simply a matter of saying, well, Chiquita is the reason there's a conflict in Colombia. I don't think anybody's saying that. But Chiquita willingly engaged, I think. At any point, they could have stopped doing what they were doing, and they continued to do it. And of course, they're just one company. And you know that, you know, there are hundreds more who are doing the same thing. You know, the idea that you can just sort of skate into Colombia and start shipping bananas and just sort of operate like a you know, an ordinary company where everything's sort of according to the law and according to these strict government regulations. I mean, it's a fantasy. You know, so the reason I think one of the reasons to write that piece I did earlier this month or last month, I guess now, on Chiquita was to say, okay, the Fiscalía has decided, the fiscal said, you know, we're going to investigate these 13 people. You know, who were in Colombia breaking laws, or, you know, allegedly breaking laws by, you know, funding the paramilitaries. Well, that's fine, but these aren't necessarily the people who are responsible for the policies. And to do that, to really get at that, you need to look at the people who were working in other countries, you know, the regional offices, the managers in Costa Rica, and of course, the top executives in Cincinnati, Ohio, in the United States. These were the people who were, you know, approving, you know, ultimately approving the systems that they set up to do this. So it's easy to blame, you know, those guys. And I think that there's a certain amount of blame that they should shoulder. You know, the people in charge of security, you know, in Colombia, the people who were keeping the books in Colombia, you know, doing the accounting, and the general manager who kind of, you know, signed off on all of the payments. Yeah, of course, they, you know, they were playing a role. They should have known that what they were doing was wrong and was illegal, and I'm sure they did. But it really wasn't their decision. So, you know, while I think it's really instructive to look at their role and how they interacted with the situation on the ground in Colombia, it's even more important, I think, that you know, that we understand that there's a bigger problem. There's impunity at much higher levels, and that's true, you know, in another sense about, you know, when you talk about, you were saying, you know, with the Colombian military, for example, you know, how do we know, you know, who were the big fish making the big decisions? And that's very much true. You know, in some of these, many of these human rights cases in Colombia are where people in the military have been tried and convicted. You know, we don't know whether we're getting to the, you know, the top levels of, you know, where were these decisions really made? And was it at the high, was it at high levels, you know, commanders in Bogota? Or are we talking about something that was a phenomenon, you know, at the sort of outer reaches? You know, these are extremely important questions. And obviously, you know, impunity is one of the big issues that a truth commission, or especially the jurisdiction, needs to tackle. Because, you know, if all you're going to do is get the small fish, then, yeah, you're really not solving the problem.
Not at all. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time now. But it's been fascinating chatting to you. I mean, really, you are a fountain of information for these issues that we've talked about. So let me just say thank you so much, Michael, for your time. And if people want to read things that you're producing, I just direct them to the National Security Archive. Is that right?
Yeah, you can. Our website. It's you can get there. NSARCHIVE. That's NSArchive.org. I think that still gets you there. You can Google it. It's easy to find. I'm really happy that you had me on, Richard. Happy to help you kick off the new year.
With a hard hitting report for the new year. But thank you again. It's been really, really fascinating talking to you. And of course, there are a lot of challenges ahead for Colombia. But, you know, we've got to be bullish, I guess. You know, we've got to be bullish. There was a great editorial written by Ricardo Silva, and it says, "Si no te gusta, váyanse." So, you know, with the people who are in favor of the current government and against a peace accord in as much as it is right now, are outspoken in saying, "Oh, well, you could always leave the country." But as Ricardo Silva said very eloquently, no, we're staying because we want to help and affect the change. And I find that to be very much the feeling that I get being here in Colombia, just, you know, throwing in my two cents a little bit, and hopefully through this show a little bit more, we can give some information and provide some information to people out there, and just you know, telling the story of how it is and what's going on in Colombia. So again, let me just take this moment to say thank you very much to Michael Evans, senior analyst and director of the Colombia Project at the National Security Archive. It's been a real pleasure. This has been episode 256 of the Colombia Calling podcast, first episode of the year. Remember, from next week, episode 257, we'll be including news updates at the beginning of the show from Adrian Alselma of Colombia Reports. So this is a very, very great partnership coming up for 2019. So thank you again for listening, and be back next week. I've got some fascinating interviewees in the pipeline, and we're going to continue this strong vein of form here on the Colombia Calling podcast. So thank you again, and bye-bye.